today's topic is designing and evaluating DSS user interfaces. So we're going to look at some examples of DSS user interfaces to evaluate them, and then we're going to talk about some design guidelines and some design principles. I recommend that you also read the column, What Rules Should Guide DSS User Interface Design? And that's an elaboration of the guidelines that are discussed in Chapter 5. And then, What DSS User Interface Design is Best for Eliciting Values? A major part of decision support is to get values, either numeric values or preference values. And we have different techniques like a graphical elicitation, verbal elicitation, or numeric elicitation. So if you're really interested in user interface design, I recommend that you read those two. The end of the Decision Support Systems book has Appendix 2, which is called User-Centered Design Checklist. There are 42 questions that you can use to help you review the user interface of a system, and they're in 5 categories. The first is that the interface is easy to understand. The second is easy orientation and navigation. We can move around in the system. 3 is that the system has features that enhance productivity. 4 is that the integrity of the decision support system is maintained. That is, that people can't put in erroneous or illogical values or responses, that it doesn't generate poor data because of the responses that are put in, that ranges for things like spinners or sliders make sense, so that you don't all of a sudden have an interest rate of 100% when that's not reasonable. And then finally, provide control to the users. The users of any application should feel in control, and that's especially true for decision support systems because we're designing them for use by managers who want to feel in control of their decision making. You'll also see that there's a press release from 9/20/2007 on a company called Quack that's working with a new Intel virtual workspace product to create 3D interfaces for virtual work. And I put some video links up, the Sun Microsystems Looking Glass demo, which all of these are at YouTube, the Virtual Battle Space Multimodal Command and Control, and there's a screenshot in today's lecture slides, the Bumptop 3D Desktop Prototype. This is an example of a three-dimensional desktop and some interesting physics that occur in the three-dimensional space. A different type of display for visualization from Xerox PARC, the home of the Xerox Star Workstation, which created most of the conventions that we saw in the Apple Lisa and Macintosh for graphical user interfaces, and that's called Focus Plus Context Screens. And then an interesting tool for analytics from Georgia Tech called Dust and Magnet, and it's a way to aggregate data in a display. Let's look at today's lecture slides. The primary assertion that I'm going to make is that the user interface is the most important component of the decision support system. It's the most important because it's what the user sees, it's what the manager perceives the decision support system is. So if they don't have a good impression of the user interface, they will not have confidence in the data that underlies the interface, or the models, or the knowledge, or any of the traditional components that we spend a lot of time on. Today, generally, most of our development effort goes into the user interface, even if we're using a toolkit or a development environment. So we need to be sensitive to the impressions of our users and potential users when we build decision support user interfaces. A definition. A user interface is a set of objects. We may call those objects a menu object or icons. It may be commands that are on a command line, or it might be other kinds of graphical representations that we attach functionality to. Most of our thinking about user interface is two-dimensional, whether it's a website or a desktop application, but now we're also having to think about three-dimensional interfaces because of tools like Second Life and some other tools like the Intel Workspace. So we have new challenges in user interface design because of the more sophisticated interfaces that we're able to build. Some people focus only on the software and what you see on the screen when they talk about the user interface, but I would argue that we have to think about the input devices that we use too. So a mouse is part of the user interface. Touch screen is part of the user interface. The input device influences what we can do in the user interface. It's very different to program for touch screen, and we can create different interfaces than we can with mouse input. And today we're looking at immersive interfaces, whether it's having sensors on your arm or a Wii wand so that you can do things, or you're actually in a virtual workspace and your whole body becomes your input device. So sensors know where you are in the virtual space, and when you walk or move in the virtual space, it actually translates into actions in the computer interface. The chapter notes that the user interface not only deals with the interaction of the user with the software, but the user interface also cues the user of the system in terms of what they can do. And we hope those cues are going to be intuitive, that you don't have a long learning time to figure out how the user interface works. I talk about it as a user interface puzzle because there's so many components that we can put together. We have a tendency to have a lot of redundancy. We have command line, we have menus, we have multiple menus, we have point and click, and we may have all of those things in one interface. Sometimes that helps and sometimes it creates confusion. The chapter talks about four main types of interfaces, the traditional two-dimensional interfaces, command line, menu, a point-and-click graphical interface where you can point to an object and click on it and something happens. It is an action enabler. And then dialogue or question and answer interfaces where you either on a menu for pull-down or in free-form text, you input information. We're expanding that with voice, so the system might ask you a question and you answer it in voice, spoken interface, and the spoken interfaces are getting more powerful. Many of you, when you interact with your bank, you'll call on the phone and it'll ask for your account number and you talk it into the system. So the voice interfaces are getting better and we're starting to see some of those in traditional interfaces and in three-dimensional. Touch, that's where you have to have a special input device or a touchpad or some other kind of a device that will recognize where your body is relative to a screen or to an immersive display. And then immersion. And immersion means that we are part of it. Many of you probably watched Star Trek Next Generation where they have the holodeck. How many of you have seen the holodecks on Star Trek Next Generation? Only one person? Okay, I'm such a big Trekkie fan. But the idea there is you're actually part of an immersive environment and the computer is playing some of the roles, but you actually interact with those computer-generated images. Now, we're a long ways from that, but our immersive environments are getting better, and I'll show you a picture of one. Most decision support system user interfaces use a combination of user interface input styles. Quick example and definition of the command line, a method of interacting via text. Believe it or not, we still have command line. And commands usually have a verb like run or load or display, followed by either the object we're acting on or the object plus parameters. Menu is where we have some kind of a list of entries. It may be a dynamic menu that's being generated from a database, or it may be a static menu. On the screen on slide 5, you can see three different menus. In the center of the screen, we have a menu of reports, and those are all hyperlinks, so satisfaction rating by region. On the left-hand side, we have some control menus, back, home, email, help, that are part of the web page display. And then at the top of the web browser, we have file, edit, view, go, communicator, and help. So we're actually in a multi-menu environment because we're using a client application, a web browser here. Now, let's take a look at the main menu in the center of the screen. What kind of criticisms would you have for these reports in the satisfaction analyzer? What's the first thing you note when you look at that menu?
It's kind of hard to read.
Okay, it's small. It's hard to read. What's the next thing you see? It doesn't appear to be ordered, does it? It's not alphabetical. I mean, we've got expectation trend at the bottom. We've got link to email in the middle.
To the logical flow?
There's no logical order there. It's not alphabetical. It doesn't appear to be in terms of use. And that's bad, because it means if you want to find something, you have to read each one. Now, it's not so bad because we only have 8 links there. But if the menu list was any longer, it would get to be burdensome that we have not imposed some order on the menu. So two things we want to do. We want to make sure that the user can easily read what's on the menu, and two, that the menu has some logical order. Now, if we use standard menus using the Microsoft conventions, we want to leave them alone. We do not want to rename menu items if we can help it. So on the file menu, if we're going to let people create a new file, use the word new, okay? And use words like open. Don't use synonyms. Try to stay with conventions in a common desktop interface unless there's a reason to switch. Graphical user interface. People still call it GUI, but some people call it GUI. I think GUI is probably the most common. When in doubt and you're talking to a manager, call it a graphical user interface. The graphical user interface in slide 6 is a web-based interface. It's built using Java, so we're actually bringing a program, in this case it's an applet, into the web browser. And we use a mouse pointer to act on objects. So for example, here we've got some icons across the top. So if we point on the pie chart, it will change the table of values for sales into a chart of sales. It will try to change what I call the representation. So rather than seeing a table, we see a chart. We also have some tabs there, and if we click on the tabs, for appliances, it would let us pick other types of products that we would display in the table. So the idea of this kind of a graphical user interface is that we can point on objects and actions happen. So it's a very immediate, direct interaction with the interface. Then question and answer. Question and answer used to be one question at a time. The old command line, terminal kind of input, the system would ask some kind of question, maybe it was pretty cryptic, and then users would type in an answer, but it would create a dialogue with the system. Today, our question and answer interfaces may be more of a form. So the example on slide 7, we have an implicit question and answer dialogue. And you see implicit question and answer dialogue in the wizards in Excel. So if you want to create a chart in Excel, you'll use the chart wizard, and it's walking you through three or four different questions about what kind of chart you want, what kind of where your data is, what you want for your horizontal and X and Y axis. And if you look closely, you'll see in the wizard, it actually has the question there. It's just what if we focus on is it the answer in the wizard, and we select things from the options that are available to us. On the web page in slide 7, the first question is implicitly, what is your name? But it just puts a label there called your name, and it expects that you'll put in both your first and last name. So it's a bit of an ambiguous question. And then it asks for your height. It does tell us the units, which is a good thing to do. It's easy to forget that there are people around the world who don't use feet and inches. All I can tell you is this is not a very good user interface if we're going to have customers that come from the European Union or Asia, because they won't understand 5 feet, 8 inches. Okay? So at a minimum, if we want it to be recognizable, we need to let people pick their units, whether it's in centimeters or feet and inches, if we really want to make that a question we ask. So everybody doesn't think of height in terms of feet and inches. And then weight, not everybody thinks about pounds, but at least we have a pull-down menu there, so we can pick pounds or kilograms. So all of a sudden it's a little more sophisticated, because our software can translate between pounds and kilograms. Then we have a question. What will you be shopping for? And we have check boxes, and we have pictures. So it could be bindings, boots, poles, or skis. You can check one or more. The good thing is you can check more than one. The bad thing is the user interface doesn't really tell users that they could choose more than one. So they assume that the user is going to click on more than one and figure it out. That's probably not a good assumption to make. And then we have a button that says, let's start shopping. When we click on that button, the computer should branch contingently based on your answers. So it should present information to you for your shopping based on your height, your weight, and what you're looking for. Now, is that enough guidance for decision support to target the user? Probably not. We should also ask, is this a gift for us, for yourself, or for somebody else? We should maybe ask about price ranges. And we have a lot of shopping decision support systems now that use this kind of implicit question and answer dialogue. Well, innovative interfaces, we have gotten much more sophisticated with form filling and implicit question and answer. Voice command language is getting better. How many of you watched 2001, A Space Odyssey? Same faces. In these classes, you've got to watch some of these decision support TV shows and movies. I mean, there's a lot of decision support in Star Trek, and there's a lot of decision support in 2001, A Space Odyssey. Well, in 2001, there's a computer named HAL, which is just one letter below IBM. If you think about it, H is below I, and A is below B, and L is below M. So clearly it was a takeoff on a smart computer named IBM, which was called HAL, which is a very human computer that goes crazy and ends up forcing them all sorts of negative consequences, which I won't tell you about. But 2001 has as its protagonist voice interaction with an intelligent computer that not only provides navigation for a spaceship, it provides all the life support for people. And the computer gets so human and is so oriented towards self-preservation that it starts killing people. Now that's a common theme with robotics and artificial life. And robotics and artificial life have a lot of decision support aspects. But voice command language is getting better. the computers, even knowledge-driven, just make suggestions. How was decision automation to the extreme? Natural language, that's where we actually can type in something and the computer's going to try to figure out what we're asking, or we can speak it. List all my customers. In natural language, we should be able to say that in voice and the computer program would display our customers. We're not there yet. And then immersive 3D, and immersive 3D may use a 2D interface like a screen. We see that in tools like Second Life or Multiverse or some of the other virtual world environments, or a cave environment, and we'll take a look at cave environments, and they're getting more sophisticated. But in a cave, we don't have just one small screen. We have display screens in front of us, on the walls, on the floor, so we're standing in the environment, and we have different views of that environment. Well, this is an example of an intelligent question interface. It's not very intelligent. What they've done is basically say, let's use pull-down menus to do queries. So managers don't have to know any structured query language. The pull-down menus, though, allow managers to generate their own queries. So you can do all products or some subset, and then that are, those are the relational operators. Business Object says it's an intelligent interface. To me, it's a menu interface for accessing data and generating reports. This is an example of the Iowa State cave. They call it a battle space multimodal command and control device. The user is in a cave, so they see the battle space on multiple displays, and then they have a hand controller. It looks like your Xbox controller. It doesn't look as nice as the Wii, you know. Okay, it's more of your traditional joystick controller. There is a video. It's about 3 or 4 minutes long, and you can actually see this person in the virtual cave environment where they're able to not only see what's happening in the battle space, but issue commands to participants in the battle space. So we're blending the computer and video images with interaction with the real space. There's also a video link, and you can go out to YouTube and do a search for Looking Glass, and you'll find that Sun Microsystems has an innovative interface called the Looking Glass, which is a bit like Vista, but much more sophisticated than Vista. If you watch the demo, you'll see you can actually turn the windows around. So we go into the display, but we can also turn them around and we can annotate the windows. And it saves our annotation on the windows. So if we want to annotate a web page, we can do it right on the window. We can type right on the back of the window. So it has a lot of different conventions than we're used to in a Microsoft environment. Some of you know that Sun recently bought MySQL and is going very much open source. So maybe we'll see a Looking Glass user interface for Linux, which would be very powerful if Sun moved aggressively into the open source desktop interface. The main thing in Chapter 7 that you have to really learn well is the ROMC design approach that's discussed in the chapter. This is an approach suggested by Ralph Sprague and Eric Carlson in their 1982 book on called Building Effective Decision Support Systems. And Sprague and Carlson say that building a decision support system involves making decisions about four key elements. Today, we don't have to make too many decisions about control aids because they come with our development environment. 25 years ago, we had to program them. Today, we buy something from Business Objects or another vendor, and most of the control aids are built into the development environment. So most of our decision support decisions get made about representations, operations, and memory aids. You need to be able to have examples of all four of those. So if I said, what is an example of a representation, you should be able to tell me that a graph or a chart is a representation. A table is a representation. Representations are the way that we display results from a database query, from a model. It's the way that we see the results. So it represents the results from our decision support system. It's what the decision maker observes from using the decision support system. So again, examples of representation: a table, a graph, could be a bar chart, it could be a line chart, and a pie chart. Those are different representations. It could be a map. A map representation is increasingly common. It could be a three-dimensional representation. It could be an animated representation. It could be static. And then operations. Operations are the things that the user of the decision support system can do. So operations may be as simple as display data on a chart. That's an operation, display the data. Moving a slider or a spinner for what-if analysis is an operation. We're using an object to control inputs, so we're able to act on the model. That's an operation. So operations are the capabilities that we build into the decision support system. And then finally, memory aids, that's the help that we provide the user of the system to remind us how to use it and what things mean. So memory aids could be as simple as mouse over help, where we go over something and a window pops up and it explains to us what to do. It could be a memo in a cell, in Excel. It could be a help page. It could be a pull down for help, where you type in a keyword and it brings up the relevant help. But memory aids are things to help the user of the decision support system. Memory aids, again, are influenced by the development environment. So the development environment may allow for mouse over, it may not. It may allow for easy creation of a manual or a help capability, and then we would use the development environment to decide what memory aids to provide. So ROMC, those are the elements that we hope to get out of our requirement solicitation from the users. What representations they want, what operations they want, what types of controls, like opening a file, saving. And that's why I say most control aids are built into the system. So you can't delete something if the system is going to ask, are you sure you want to delete it? That's a control aid. We're getting more and more innovative representations. The slide 13 shows some representations. We call them heat maps. We may have visual simulations where things move around on the display. We may be simulating a factory and you see product moving through the factory, and we may be simulating a bank and you see people walk in. So our representations have become dynamic. They may be three-dimensional or two-dimensional. Some may be two-and-a-half-dimensional. That is, it's basically a 2D representation, but you've got some sense of depth in it. Or you can spin it around. You can rotate it and look at it from different approaches. Chapter 5 talks about building the interface and gives you some guidelines. I'm going to let you read that over. Most user interface development is rapid prototyping using a development environment. So we oftentimes start with the requirements and then we go and build samples. We do that a lot with the web. We quickly throw together examples of what the user interface is going to look like. If you're conscious of these elements in decision support design, you're going to focus mainly on the operations and the representations initially. Memory aids we do last. Controls are built into the development environment. So we design screens and we show them to people. We get feedback and we don't get wedded to our initial designs. Or we have alternative designs, knowing that our design sense may be different than what our users respond to. And we pay attention to the interaction. We observe people using the application we're doing. We take our use cases and we make sure that people can try each of the uses that they should see in the user interface. Showing graphs and pictures and charts communicates a lot of information. There's an old saying that a single picture conveys the same amount of information as 1,000 words. I don't know if it's quite 1,000, but for a lot of information displays, a good chart simplifies a massive amount of data. It helps us see patterns, it helps us aggregate that data, and the chart conveys more than a written word description of it or seeing the raw data. Color enhances the interface. Be careful of what I call bold colors and be aware that certain colors impact people's perception. I've done a lot of research on color. You want to be very careful when you use pure colors like red or green. Use red if you want somebody to stop doing something. We use it as a stoplight. Use green if things are good. And only use those bright reds and greens for that purpose and use it very sparingly in your interface. On the web, certain colors render better in browsers than others. Web-friendly colors. The same thing is true on the desktop if you do a .NET application or an Excel application. I generally recommend that you use pastels. That is, that you don't use vivid, strident colors in your interface. Test the color match with users. Make sure the colors don't clash and that the colors help people understand what you want. Tutorial 7 suggested that you highlight the input areas in yellow. Picking the right yellow is important. Excel uses a fairly pale yellow, not a bright yellow. And the reason they use yellow is because they want you to be cautious. They want you to be aware of those cells, but they want you to be careful what you type in there. So choosing the right colors can make a big difference in the usability of the interface. Symmetry, and there's a picture of a symmetrical interface in Chapter 5. The idea of symmetry is that when we look at the screen, it seems balanced and that the objects are in proper proportion so that the graphical representation doesn't overwhelm the user and that the type sizes that we use are appropriate. That menu, a number of you were concerned that it was hard to read because the font that was used to display those reports was too small. Part of symmetry is the appropriate balance between our font sizes, the objects we place, and the operations on the screen for a typical monitor. One caution to you in terms of developing Excel. If you have a big monitor at home and you do your application in a 19-inch monitor, it may not look quite as good when you display it up here on the screen as it did on the 19-inch monitor. A quick way to fix that in Excel is to go and change it so that it's at 75% or 60%. And then you have the problem that the font sizes may look too small because you're showing us something other than a 100% view of your design. So do think about the display environment where the user interface is going to be observed by your users when you do your design. The best thing to do is build in the environment that the users are going to actually use. So don't use 21-inch monitors if the largest monitor that's going to be on the desktop of your users is 17-inch, because you'll get a distorted view of what they see. And then when you build the interface, make sure that you have verbal cues and help and pull down guidance so the user knows what to do. Some guidelines, and I only picked out 5. I listed the most important one, the column, the frequently asked questions on guidelines. Talks about these in more detail, and they're discussed in Chapter 5. Strive for consistency. If you want your user to like your interface, you don't want to surprise your user. So from one screen to another, you want a consistent look and feel, and you want it to be intuitive, and as much as possible, you want it to be the same as other applications they frequently use. So we borrow a lot from Microsoft interfaces, even though they have some problems, just because people are familiar with those placements. So if in a non-Microsoft application you see File in a menu bar at the top, it's because somebody is trying to be similar to a Microsoft application and put File in a familiar place. Provide informative feedback. It wasn't too many years ago that we'd have feedback that said something like, you have encountered a 509 error, or runtime error. Okay. As much as possible, you don't want those errors to occur. So with your Visual Basic for application in Excel, you don't want people to go into the debugger. That's bad. But if there are errors that occur, like they type in a value that's out of the range, the feedback that you give should be informative. It should tell them what range those values should be if you're doing data validation. So informative feedback is very important. When I say create design dialogues to create closure, that is, if you're walking people through some kind of a question and answer dialogue, they should feel after they've answered the questions that they have given you useful information and complete information. Permit easy reversal of actions. The greatest invention for most of us was when somebody came up with the idea of undo. Much more powerful than redo. And when you can do multiple undos, that's really great, because you can go back to the point where you got it right. And when we have applications like Word and Excel, especially Word, where Word tries to anticipate what you want done, oftentimes it's not what you want. So you want to undo it, and you want to go back and figure out how to get it to look the way you want it to in the word processor. The last one I want to remind you of is to reduce information overload, or manage load. And I think that's better, to really say there's going to be an information load when people look at the interface. They have to read things, they see things. You don't want it to be too cluttered with information. You don't want it to be too visually overloading in terms of what you see there. So you want to manage the load. Different people process information differently. Managers, they maybe can handle a little bit more information than some people, but even there, you need to be careful about how much information you display on one screen. Slide 17 goes over a number of factors that influence design success. Designing the interface is expensive and time-consuming, but it is critical to effective system performance. So do think about these issues of ease of recall, learning time, adaptability, and speed, how long it takes to get a response. One of the factors there, uniformity of the interface, just make a note that that's the same as consistency in your design. So it's just another way of talking about that guideline of consistency. Well, the last slide I want to look at, and we're done for today, is there are some emerging user interface issues and animation. We're seeing a lot more animation, and it's more realistic. We're looking at user interface for mobile computing. You see that with the iPhone, where now we have bigger display screens for mobile computing. We still have tablet PCs. They haven't caught on quite as much as people thought, but it gives us even a bigger mobile display. There are a lot of accessibility issues for people who have vision and other kinds of handicaps that influence their ability to interact with computers. Speech synthesis and speech recognition are improving. Speech synthesis is where the computer talks to us. Speech recognition is where the software recognizes what we're saying. The last one, and I included it on the syllabus, is 3D user interfaces. We have a whole host of new issues. There I'm hoping to write a column either this week or next week, or in 3 weeks, I guess, on design guidelines for 3D user interfaces and the challenges we face. We still, unless we're in an immersive environment, we don't have real 3D environments, but as we get more immersion, we get new 3D environments. And we're getting new tools, like the Wii Wand, where we can actually move our hand and it's like we're bowling, okay? Or we're playing golf and we're swinging the club. That's a whole new level of interaction with the user interface because we have a new kind of input device and the software recognizes input from that device. Okay, a few review questions on slide 19. I guess the basic thing to say is make sure that you read chapter 5, you go over the review questions, and that you have a good idea of the different kinds of user interface styles, and that you understand the ROMC design approach and how to go about building user interfaces. A very crucial part of an effective decision support system.